Well, we have a full house again for our second hearing of the day. It's also very nice. Again, it looks like it's Sussex Hamilton High School, and if that's the case, would they, the students and their advisors and teachers, please stand? Thank you very much. Please be seated. Do we have any other students that are here with us today? Okay. Just a lot of interest in this case. That's always a good thing, too. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Then next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Michael Gableman, and at the far end of the bench, Justice Daniel Kelly. Before we begin, we have a little bit of a different lineup, so I just want to be sure that I have the time we are all on the same page. Attorney Essenberg, you're going to begin for 25 minutes, then 10 minutes with Attorney Ian Bienski. 40 minutes with Christine Hamill, and 5 minutes with Attorney Essenberg. Correct? All right. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. My name is Rick Essenberg with my colleague Clyde Taylor. I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, arguing the cause of John Krieger. Thank you for hearing his case this morning. His case is, as the respondents suggest, about drawing lines. But in drawing those lines, this court has a strong and clear directive from the legislature. Open meetings law is to be construed liberally in favor of openness and disclosure. The presumption is for public access and not against it. It is in favor of the fullest and most complete information regarding the affairs of government compatible with the conduct of government business. Now, this does not mean that those seeking access to any meeting of government employees will always win. But the open meetings law is not to apply narrowly. Courts are not charged with attempting to find a way out. Both for the government and for the public, compliance and enforcement of the open meetings law is not a formalistic undertaking under which only the most obvious gatherings are open, and it is not a complicated game of Simon Says or Hide the Ball, in which clever lawyers can tweak and obfuscate even those most obviously covered gatherings to keep the public out.
Professor Essenberg, on page 24 of your brief, going into page 25, you articulate the rule your client proposes. At the bottom of page 24, the rule Krieger proposes is simply this, and it has several elements. A group that looks and acts like a formal committee, that draws its authority to act from a governmental body, and that has specified members appointed by those with authority to do so, is a governmental body and subject to the open meetings law. Now, the question that came to my mind when I read that, and that I had in the back of my mind while I was reading the briefs, one of the questions I had was, okay, say this was a committee not to review the books to be used in a reading class, English class, but say it was a standing committee on holiday parties that the school put together pursuant to rule and had standing committee members and had regular meetings coinciding with the times pertinent to the various holidays during the season. Would that fall under the rule that your client proposes?
It's hard to imagine how that would. Here we have a situation where the school board delegated a particular function to the assessment, curriculum, and instruction department of the Appleton School Board.
That's 361.1.
That's 361.1. And it said in 361.1 that the process for doing that will be delineated in a handbook. The handbook was promulgated. It was then approved by the board. And the handbook says that when you review educational materials to make a recommendation to the board, you have to act by committee. That's what makes this subject to the open meetings law, although it would also, I think, be the case if a high-ranking official had created the committee.
Council,
in the case of a holiday party, we have no question of delegation of power. We probably don't have a high-ranking official who has created the holiday party. I think that under those circumstances, and it may not even be, well, I suppose it could be, your hypothetical. You're the master of your hypothetical, but most holiday committees probably don't have defined membership and regular meetings. But I don't think in that case it's very likely that the open meetings law would apply.
Because you're saying it would be unlikely that there would be a rule with the equivalence of the delegation from the board similar to 361.1.
It's unlikely that it would either be that or it would be something that was formed by a high-ranking official like, you know, the school superintendent or the people who are in charge of the ACI department.
Oh, okay, but say it was. Say the principal of the school said, gee, we have these people running around in a disorganized fashion every time. And say it was holiday programs for students. Who's going to organize the holiday programs for students where they can display their talents and provide entertainment for their parents? You know, the usual school program kind of thing.
Well, I think in that would be if the distinction between that case and this case would be that there had not been a delegation of a power that is held by the board either to the body or to a high-ranking governmental official in order to create it. Now, it's not clear, quite frankly, under the law, that that type of express delegation is necessary. But I think that a holiday committee is probably going to fall below the line. Although, you know, if I you know, there could be instances where dealing with holiday observances in a school district does become subject to the open.
Well, those can get controversial too. But to bring it back to the facts, you're saying that because the board has the ultimate authority for setting the curriculum.
In this case, that's correct.
Right. That 361.1 was a specific delegation of that part of the board's authority in a way that planning holiday parties, holiday programs, without saying more, would not be.
Right. Because what the open meetings law is really designed to get at is it's designed to get at where the real work of government is happening. The legislature decided that sausage making, if you want to call it that, has to happen in public. And so when you have a situation like you have here where a school board...
You are aware of the irony of making that statement to a group that meets in secret, right?
I'm a huge proponent of separation of powers, Justice.
Perfect.
When you have a school board who specifies, who delegates an authority, specifies a process by which that authority is to be exercised, says that if you are going to review educational materials and make recommendations to us to adopt them, you need to do it by a committee. At that point, from that point on, the ACI was charged to whenever it decided that it wanted to change educational materials to do so by committee. And that is precisely what happened here.
So, Council, let me, given that structure that you just laid out, let's overlay that on the facts of this case. My understanding is that the camera, can we call the committee that? camera? Can we do
the
that?
Curriculum Arts Material Review Committee?
Yeah, that one.
I am told by my colleagues that the preferred acronym is CAMRIC.
CAMRIC?
CAMRIC.
Got it. So my understanding is the CAMRIC was originally formed not to review curriculum, but to consider a parent's request for an alternative Communication Arts 1 class. Is that correct?
No, I don't think that that's correct. I don't think the record supports that. I think Mr. Steinhilber testified in his deposition that it was formed for three purposes. One was to respond to Mr. Krieger's request for an alternative course. One was to review the educational materials, the sort of the reading list, because it hadn't been updated for a long, long time. And another was to review that reading list in light of the then extant Common Core standards, which would require a change between the balance of fiction and nonfiction materials. All three of these things, according to Mr. Steinhilber, were why the committee was created. As would be suggested by its name, the Communications Arts Material Review Committee.
Is that an uncontested fact?
Pardon?
Is this an uncontested fact Is it an uncontested fact that the committee was given these three charges simultaneously, essentially?
Mr. Steinhilber testified that that's why the committee was formed, and that certainly appears to be what the committee did. I don't believe there is support in the record for the proposition that the committee had some extant life that went on before it decided to review educational materials. In our view, however, that doesn't matter. The Attorney General correspondence, the TILCA correspondence in particular, makes clear that something that is pre-existing, like the management team that was involved in that case, can become a government body if it is assigned a task by rule and order and proceeds to exercise it. So in our view, and we think it's pretty clear from the record that it was from the get-go, but whether it was or not, once the Materials Review Committee decided that it would perform the task that had been delegated to the ACI department to be performed by a committee, it became a governmental body. It's really, really quite simple. When a school district says, we want you to perform a task, when you perform the task, you need to do it this way, and then you proceed to perform that task in the way that you were instructed to perform it, the open meetings law ought to apply.
All right, so now on that, would the CAMRIC be a governmental body then as a consequence of Rule 361.1 and the handbook, or as a consequence of Mr. Steinhilber's direction?
I think that the clearer argument, and our principal argument, that it is because of 361.1 in the handbook. However, I think it's also clear from the guidance that has been given to us by the Attorney General over the years that if a task is delegated to a school district and a high-ranking official then forms a committee in order to carry out that task, that too makes it subject to the open meetings law. So I think that Mr. Krieger prevails either way. I think in this case, however, it's pretty clear that what happened here was that the school district set up a process with 361.1 and approval of the handbook that was to govern the review of educational material. And it doesn't matter, I don't think, why it is, what was the impetus for the district to decide to review educational materials. It doesn't matter if it was Common Core standards. It doesn't matter if, you know, the district came into some money and now had the funds to provide new books. It doesn't matter if a new energetic administration came in and wanted to change things up. What's important here is the fact that they were performing the task that was delegated to them. not the motivation or the impetus. It seems to me that if we made the open meetings law turn on this question of motivation or intent, courts would typically be subject, would be entangled in some type of subjective determination of, well, what was the real motivation? Did they really do it because of Mr. Krieger's complaint, or did they really do it because they wanted to review the educational materials? The fact of the matter is that they did both of these things. And there's nothing in the open meetings law that suggests that a government body that's performing a delegated task becomes not a government body performing a delegated task and not subject to the open meetings law because it does something other than the delegated task.
And if this was created as pursuant to Mr. Steinhelber's directive rather than the rule in the handbook, can we decide as a matter of law what constitutes a high-ranking official, or is that a jury question?
Well, I think in this case we can decide it as a matter of law. If we look at the Attorney General guidance, and particularly the 1978 Attorney General opinion, the Attorney General has advised local units of government that the definition of a high-ranking official is quite broad. I talked about property managers and, district department heads. In this case, however, line drawing is always difficult. But in this case, I think it's rather easy, because the even if you think that 361.1 in the handbook isn't what dictated the process that moved forward here, it is undisputed that Mr. Steinhelber, who was the head of the ACI department, and his adjutant, Ms. Bonnow, were the ones who proceeded with this. And the ACI department was the very department to which this task of selecting educational materials had been delegated by the board. So while line drawing can be difficult, this line isn't, I think, particularly difficult to draw at all. I think that wherever that line may fall, and the Attorney General guidance suggests to us that the line is not very high. It's not a high, it's not a high barrier to get over. But in this case, we're well above that line because of the nature of the people who are involved here in deciding to do this.
Counsel, one of the things that all of us, I'm sure, are concerned about is to come up with a proper balance, because these are big questions in terms of open government almost versus functioning government, it seems, so we are proceeding to address. The Attorney General takes a different approach than you take, as you just indicated, not focusing so much on the status of the high-ranking official. Is such and such a person a high-ranking, or high-ranking enough such that it might be a jury question, as was just posited, but rather one of delegation, and they focus on delegation. Isn't that a narrower approach than you're taking, and a more an approach that allows for a more definite line drawing?
I'm not sure that the distinction that we're taking is it may be more semantical than it might be more a semantic distinction than anything else. I think that in our case, what we're saying is that wherever that line may be drawn, here we have a high-ranking official, the person who headed the department to whom the task had been delegated. The Attorney General, and I think in 78 Attorney General opinion, said that it can be a much lower-ranking official than the people that we have involved here, and it can be presumed that they are acting in accordance with the law, because in that decision involving the DNR, there was no there were no facts that suggested that the DNR had delegated the particular charge to form these advisory committees to any of the lower-ranking officials that, in fact, did so. So
but
it seems to me it's – I'm sorry.
Finish your sentence. And
it seems to me that framing it in that way that the Attorney General does is both narrower and broader than the way that we have formed it. But I think in the context of this case, there really is no distinction.
Well, let me push further on that. The Attorney General says essentially the authority was delegated by the superintendent to these two folks, Steinhilber and Bunau. And then they redelegated it to this committee. So you have a delegation and a re-delegation, if you will. I mean, under your argument, needing the delegation to a high-ranking official, don't you run into a problem? What if the superintendent said, okay, Mrs. Smith, I know you don't have any highfalutin title, but you are the person that knows this best. You're not a high-ranking official at all, but I want you to take charge of this, and Mrs. Smith gets busy and she brings in a committee which may even include Steinhilber and Bunau. Who knows? Yes. And so that's the problem with your approach, I think. It may hang us up on, is this person high enough? How high or how low do you go? Why even have that in your analysis?
It's a fair point, Justice Bradley. And I think you've done a good job of articulating why I was trying to suggest, perhaps not as clearly as I could have, that the difference is semantic in the sense that I believe that if somebody like the superintendent or if somebody like Steinhilber had redelegated to someone of his or her choosing, that certainly would not be a way to accept the subsequent body from the open meetings law, because as the Attorney General has opined over the years, if you allowed that to happen, it would be too easy to avoid the meaning of the application of the open meetings law. As you suggest, superintendent would just go and say, okay, Mr. Smith, you know more about this than anybody else. You don't have a fancy title. I'll let you do it. We wouldn't want the local unit of government to be able to come back and say, well, Mr. Smith, well, he just doesn't have enough heft. So the open meetings law doesn't apply. So in that sense, In the case of a redelegation such as that, I absolutely agree with you.
But that's right. That last sentence you just used confines it to the scenario of a redelegation. What it doesn't take into account is the second horse you seem to be riding, which is that it was delegation pursuant to rule in this instance, 361.1. So say Smith, To follow Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's hypothetical, but to add to it, the delegation occurs, and Smith, instead of just coming up with an ad hoc procedure, looked through the books and said, well, here's a rule that seems like it would be a good guide to carry out this task, and then performs it pursuant to that rule. I assume your conclusion would be different in that instance.
Well, if I understand you correctly, I mean, a rule could be something like 361.1 in the handbook,
yes.
Something that has been enacted by a governing body and is denominated as a rule. But nothing in 1982 says that only a governing body acting pursuant to some type of rulemaking process. The Attorney General has made clear that rule and order can be formal or informal. The Attorney General has made clear that, sure, as in this case, it can be the promulgation of a rule by the school board and the approval of the handbook by the school board, but it also could be delegation to a high-ranking official, and we have that here because Rule 361.1 actually does delegate this responsibility to the ACI department, but it also can be, you know, delegation to an official within the school district who then issues a rule and order, says, Mr. Smith, you know more about this than anybody else. Why don't you form a committee in order to formulate recommendations? That can be a rule and order, too.
Does the issue that you presented to the court lend itself to the court making a general pronouncement or a rule governing the statutory interpretation question, or is this really a fact-intensive consideration for the court?
I think that there can be, this is an opportunity for the court to clarify, and I think, you know, what we have here is we have a situation, and just approaching this from the perspective of an advocate, we have a situation where you have a series of attorney general, you have an attorney general opinion and a series of correspondence that makes clear that, yeah, this is really the outline of the open meetings law, and if you apply the open meetings law in the way that the Attorney General has been telling local units of government that it should be applying them, and the Attorney General certainly isn't going to usher in a parade of horribles on government officials, that if you apply it the way the Attorney General has suggested that it should be applied, the open meetings law applies here. But what there hasn't been is an opportunity for this court to weigh in and say, yeah, we think that this is the way that it ought to happen, that a rule or order can be formal or informal, that that when a governmental body directs that something be happen in a particular way, or when an official directs that something happen in a particular way, and that's what happens, then the meeting has to be open to the public. So I think that what can happen here is this court can build upon the guidance that has been provided by the Attorney General over the years, exercising his or her special statutory responsibility with respect to the open meeting law, and make clear that, yes, this is exactly how you have to deal with that. Because what we have happened here is in a situation where the open meetings law seemed to clearly apply, the Appleton School District decided that it would close that meeting, and the reason that it would do it is because it didn't want the very process that had been delegated to it by the board, the selection of educational materials, to happen in the open, because they were afraid that Mr. Krieger would let the public know what was going on. My time is up.
Thank you very much.
And when you come back, I'd like you to talk about the relationship between order and a governmental body, and especially page 9 of the and following of the AG's brief.
Page 9 of the AG's brief?
Thank you. Volume, issue 2. Okay.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Ann Bensky, and I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General's office, and we filed an amicus brief in this case. Thank you for giving this office some time to discuss this issue with you. I want to emphasize the Attorney General's legal analysis on what constitutes a rule or order under the open meetings law, and I'm specifically going to focus on the word order. The Attorney General has used rule and order somewhat interchangeably, but I think for this case especially, because there is the Rule 361 that we're dealing with, I'm going to focus on the definition of the word order. The Attorney General's office has developed the closest thing that we have to a full body of case law on the meaning of the word order in the open meetings law. There's nearly 30 years of legal analysis that demonstrates that the Attorney General's interpretation of the word order in 19.82 sub 1 is a practical and workable definition that preserves the utmost transparency required under the open meetings law while respecting the need for governments to be able to function efficiently.
Ms. Bensky.
Yes.
Ms. Bensky, is Professor Essenberg correct when he opines that application of the analysis set forward in the Attorney General's brief to the facts in this case would lead to the conclusion that the committee meetings held in this instance were subject to open meeting laws?
Again, we're not here to choose sides, but my interpretation of the facts, with the caveat that I have not personally reviewed the entire record, I've only reviewed the briefs, I do see facts to suggest that the Attorney General would, if this had come to the Attorney General requesting an opinion, that the Attorney General would likely determine that a court could find that the committee was a governmental body.
Would it find that it was a meeting? In your brief, you start out with saying it's an order, right? And you take the Court of Appeals to task and say they got that wrong.
Yes.
Then you get into governmental body and you say the parties kind of agree that it's a governmental body. I think on page 10 of your brief you do that.
Yeah, so the in the Court of Appeals opinion there is a footnote saying that the parties agreed that what occurred would be a meeting under the definition of meeting in the law.
Okay, that's not quite what I was referring to, not the definition of meeting, but the definition of a collective body. Let me see if I can find that. On page 10, the second full sentence. In the present case, the parties agree the review committee fit that definition, and that definition is a definition of a collective body as opposed to meeting.
Yes, again, my understanding of the record and the undisputed facts in the record were that the parties had agreed that this group of individuals was a collective body, and I think the record supports that from my independent view of it. There's a group of a wide swath of people who were engaging in collective decision-making. They came up with a decision, and they forwarded that collective decision on.
Counsel, how does your analysis differ? And I believe it does, but how does it differ from the argument that we just heard in analytical framework?
Again, my understanding of the record is that what the Attorney General's brief focuses on may have been the substance of the reply brief in the Court of Appeals.
Okay. So how does your argument set forth in your amicus brief differ from the argument that we just heard?
We do not focus on the school board rule 361. So the Attorney General's argument assumes that 361 doesn't exist and just asked, did the assistant superintendent have the authority to create this body? And was the authority had the authority been delegated to him somehow, either by statute or rule, or did he inherently have that authority because of his position? Did he have the authority to direct the government's business? And did he form the committee for that purpose?
I didn't see anything in your brief talking about did he have the inherent authority. I just saw your brief as saying that the superintendent had the authority, that he delegated the authority to the Steinhuber, I guess, and he redelegated it. You didn't get into any kind of inherent authority of an assistant superintendent.
Well, again, I guess the brief didn't focus on the specific facts of this case. Some of the Attorney General opinions suggest, especially the Paulus correspondence from 2001, suggests that when you have somebody who works for a school board in a position that has authority to direct the government's business, that person is able to give an order creating a governmental body without necessarily having to have the school board say, I want you to do this, and then the next person turns around and says, I want you to do this. That authority, so I guess the word inherent authority means that the authority that exists within that person's position, do they have the authority to direct the school board's business by virtue of their position? And I think this gets to some of the questions that were being asked earlier, I believe, by Justice Gableman.
Well, you got two things in your brief. First, what's an order? First, what is an order, right? And then the second one on 9 and 10, what's a government body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you make the point that meetings between administrators or employees aren't open meeting under the law. That's why I asked my question of Mr. Essenberg. So what is your position? I'm not sure I understood your brief, frankly. I'm not sure I understand what you're saying now. So what is an order? It doesn't have to be formal. It doesn't have to be in writing. What does it have to be?
An order is asking, it's from a person to another person asking them to do something. The Attorney General guidance from the early 80s relied on the dictionary definition of the word order, which is an authoritative mandate from a superior to a subordinate.
Well, that just can include anything like bring me coffee at 3 o'clock every day.
Well, the order would be an order to create a commission or board or council.
Okay. So, if you have an order and it creates a government body, that's what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, so the order has to create a government body.
The order now, has to create a governmental body.
Okay.
Yes.
So that brings us to the second part of your brief at page 9 and following of what is a government body. Now, not every meeting of people that have authority is a government body, right?
Not every governmental meeting is subject to the open meetings law because they don't have all of the various attributes that are necessary.
So what are the various attributes? What are the various attributes necessary?
Well, there are several.
Because what you don't want, unless you want to destroy government, you don't want every meeting of every administrator or every employee to be an open meeting that has to be noticed, because there's a lot that goes on that doesn't have to be noticed, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what are the attributes?
You need a clearly defined group of people. That is not a mere assemblage. They need to act collectively. And this goes to the definition of what a meeting is, as well as the very first part of a definition of a governmental body. They need to be given a governmental duty. And I think that's something that could rise to the level of an executive decision. Whether to have punch or soda at the Christmas party does not rise to a level of a governmental decision. However,
if it's whether it has intoxicating beverages or punch, might.
None of that in government, Justice.
Really?
But
raise your right hand and repeat that.
But if there was a decision about whether a school was allowed to have a Christmas pageant, that is something, that is a big policy decision, and I would expect that a lot of these big policy initiatives of a school board are written down somewhere, which gives a definition of what are the school board's duties, what are these real key important governmental duties, and a meeting of a group of people, even if it's a defined department of people, is usually, and I go to a lot of these meetings, it's usually not working as a collective group, coming up with a collective work product that has a definite impact on an issue that raises to the level of a governmental issue. And when we speak in these terms, it sounds more amorphous, but looking at the Attorney General correspondence, you can see that the Attorney General's definition, as outlined in our brief, shows that this is workable. When you ask yourself these questions, who gave the order? Under what authority? What did they tell them to do? Was a group created? did they act collectively? And then there's the context question. Was there a work product? Did they merely talk about how they were going to carry out a policy initiative that had already been decided, or were they helping to create policy? Were they giving recommendations?
Thank you, Council.
When all of those questions are asked, it becomes very simple.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
I appreciate your answering my questions.
You prepared to go?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Christine Hamill. I'm with the law firm of Von Breezen and Roper. Seated with me at counsel's table is Andrew Phillips, also of Von Breezen and Roper. And we're here on behalf of the Appleton Area School District Board of Education and the Communication Arts One Materials Review Committee, known for purposes of this litigation as CAMREC.
Counsel, before you begin further, I'm having a hard time hearing you, and it's the sound in this room, and my mic next to me is not working at all this morning. So if you could maybe raise the mic a little bit.
Is that better?
Yeah, that is better. Thank
okay.
you very much.
She's fine with me.
As we've talked about, this is a case about drawing lines, but here the line has already been drawn, and it has been drawn clear, and it's clearly understandable. It's been drawn for decades. It's been drawn by the legislature, and it is the line between a group of individuals that is subject to the open meetings law and a group of individuals that is not subject to the open meetings law. And this is a distinction between the policymaking function of government and the administrative function of government. Neither the petitioner here or the supporting amici recognize this very important and very clear distinction between policymaking and administrative function. In order to be a committee to be deemed a governmental body, pursuant to the statute, it must be created by constitution, statute, ordinance, rule, or order. There must be a directive from the governmental body, and it must be formal. The petitioner's position is to broadly define governmental body to include all governmental business. That's a term that's used throughout the petitioner's brief, governmental business. But there is no such thing as an employee acting within the scope of his or her responsibilities that is not conducting governmental business. And that is why we are concerned with the vast implications of what the petitioner is asking this court to do. If this court were to do what the petitioner is asking it to do, the court would essentially be redrawing that line that has been established by the legislature, contrary to the language of the statute itself.
Wasn't that done in the first referenced attorney general letter or opinion when they went to a common dictionary definition for the word order? Didn't that broaden it out at the outset, and then all of the decisions since then have piggybacked one on the other?
Well, it potentially broadened it out at the outset, but I think the language that the Attorney General uses is a little bit troubling. Sure, there's the dictionary definition of what the word order is, but the Attorney General correspondence has taken it one step further.
When I look at the statute, I don't have it right in front of me, but it refers to something like, you know, constitution, statute, something else, rule or order. And if you apply, as we often do, the tool for statutory interpretation of justum generis, which means of the same kind, a verbal directive is not of the same kind as the constitution or the statute, or in what we ordinarily interpret a rule or an order to be as a formalistic written instrument.
Correct, and I think that's where there is an issue with the language that is used by the Attorney General in suggesting that a rule or order could ever be informal. Governmental bodies don't work in informal manners. They work in a formal manner. They operate by virtue of having a quorum. They make policy by virtue of taking votes. There's nothing informal about what a governmental body does.
If we look at the facts of this case, isn't this committee squarely under the definition of a governmental body, because here we do have the formality of a committee that has been delegated authority, and I know that gets to the heart of the issue, but we do have a rule from the Board of Education that selection of education materials is delegated to professionally trained and certified personnel employed by the school system. Isn't that what happened here? We have a committee that was delegated the responsibility of looking at the curriculum, the textbooks, the education materials for the communication arts one class. This wasn't just the superintendent saying to administrators, hey, we've got a parent complaining about some books that might have sexually oriented content. Deal with that complaint. They actually established a committee to do a look over the entire curriculum for this class. Isn't that getting into the policymaking responsibilities of the board?
It is not. If you look at the facts of this case, this committee was formed in response to a parent complaint. A parent came in, Mr. Krieger came to the superintendent, expressed his displeasure and concern with the curriculum for the Communication Arts One course, and requested that an entirely separate course be created.
But the committee's work, you concede, was not by any means limited to addressing the parent's complaint.
It certainly was not. The committee itself elected to expand the role of the committee into taking a look at Common Core. Common Core was coming down the pipe, and the committee would be remiss not to consider what the implications of Common Core might be a couple years down the road.
But so it also had the obligation, Ms. Hamill, to look at it every 6 years, and it had been 8 years since it had been reviewed. So wouldn't that sort of underscore the point that Justice Rebecca Bradley was making, that it was carrying out the official functions of a rule?
Well, it was not carrying out the official functions of the rule, and here's why. There's testimony in the record from Ms. Bunnell indicating that, yes, this committee was formed in response, first and foremost, to a parent complaint. In looking at that parent complaint, the committee determined that an alternative course probably wasn't necessary, and that instead they should simply look to the current curriculum and see if perhaps there might be changes that could be made to the current book list. And so they looked at the current book list, again, taking into account Common Core. That process that is laid out in the ACI handbook, that the so-called directive or order that comes from Rule 361.1, was not at play here. There's testimony in the record by Ms. Bunnell indicating that that committee was not performing the functions of those curriculum committees that are detailed in the ACI handbook.
But there's also testimony that 361.1 was the only rule on point by which they could review the curriculum.
And I think that testimony is taken out of context, because when you consider the testimony as a whole, yes, there's Rule 361.1, which Ms. Bunnell and Mr. Steinhilber recognize that the board fell under. Yes, there is the ACI handbook, which certainly helps to guide the decisions of the ACI department. But in terms of what the committee did itself, that was really the brainchild of Nan Bunnell and Kevin Steinhilber. They took a parent complaint, looked at it to see what exactly it was, how they might appropriately respond, and essentially said, hey, there's this rule, there's this handbook that already exists that says a process that we can utilize if we're looking at books. Why don't we use it here to review this book list to respond to this parent complaint? They were doing that in the performance of their responsibilities as administrators of a school district, part of their administrative function.
Do we want to get into, Professor Essenberg alluded in his original presentation, should we or any court get into the reasons why a committee was formed? Because there could be all sorts of subjective reasons known only to the people who decided to form the committee. For example, he alluded to, and the record supports the idea, that one of the concerns of the school district is that Mr. Krieger had attended meetings in the past where teachers had expressed some viewpoint, it's not defined, and that Mr. Krieger had related those opinions to the public at large. And so I'm worried that if the court or if we adopt a rule that requires courts to look into the whys of reasons for the committees being formed, we're going to open up just a morass that will be inescapable.
I would agree with you. I think that the if you do as is suggested, that you look at what is the reason that this committee was formed, what is the substance that this committee is looking at, then you open up a whole can of worms. And I think that's why it's important to look at the statute itself. What does the statute say? And that's where...
And in answer to that question, as Justice Ann Walsh Bradley referred, on pages 22 going into 23 of your brief, you write, a governmental body is defined as, quote, a state or local agency, board, commission, committee, council, department, or public body, corporate, and politic created by constitution, statute, ordinance, rule, or order. And that is 1982 sub 1. And so why isn't 361.1 in combination with the handbook a rule?
Well, 361.1 in the handbook would not be rules, and here's why. Because the distinction that is set forth in the open meetings law is, as you mentioned, constitution, statute, ordinance, rule, or order. And there also has to be this directive that is given by the board, by the governmental body, that rule or order directive has to be there. You have to have it. It also has to be a function of the governmental body that the group is performing. Simply because a group is performing responsibilities and a group gets together and performs a function doesn't necessarily make it a body that is subject to the open meetings law.
Okay, so how do we limit it that way? Where is the language to support that reading? Because what I see... It is reference to a rule. 361.1 is a rule created by the board that lists how curricula are to be determined. The text, this is the route, this is the avenue that the district's representatives chose to take. They, by following a rule, and so I'm having trouble finding the limiting language. You see my point, and you saw the converse of it when I asked about the planning for holiday parties or school programs. You know, obviously, there has to be, as Justice Abrahamson alluded to, some end to it. Otherwise, the work of government would not get done. But we have to look to the language that the legislature chose to use. And so I'm asking where we would find support for your limitation.
Well, I think you have to find support for the limitation because there has to be a distinguishing line between how we're defining governmental business and what is governmental business that is subject to the open meetings law. It's a difference between the legislative function of government and the executive function
and
of government.
And certainly, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you are just setting good issues up here. One of the things that I noted, and I did not have time to ask Ms. Bensky about it, is when she gave the elements of a meeting, or her factors, I think she used the word, clearly defined group that of people that acts collectively, who have been given a governmental duty, that rises to the level of a governmental decision, and then she compared and contrasted the choices of whether to serve soda or something else as compared to whether to have a Christmas program compared to a holiday program. But then she went on to define or describe further governmental decision as key, comma, important. That was the quote that I wrote down at the time. And to get to what I think you're alluding to is a question that came to my mind during that, which is, well, gee, is the decision whether to teach the book, have the students read Gone with the Wind as opposed to Catcher in the Rye, does that really arise to the level of governmental decision that we want to have subject to the open meeting clause? I don't know if I've illustrated your point or mangled it. You educate me.
Why don't you say illustrate?
I would agree. I would concur with that. Well, and I think you've brought forth what the sort of the problem is with the line that petitioner is suggesting here, is that the line being suggested, there really is no logical stopping point if you say that the line has to be drawn at governmental business, because as I mentioned, everything that governmental employees do is government business. There isn't a single act or incident or issue that governmental employees deal with that is not connected to governmental business. So there has to be a way to distinguish it. And I think it's clear that the distinguishing factor is when the board is engaging in legislative functions versus executive functions. And choosing something like, are we going to read Gone with the Wind in this Communication Arts 1 course, is certainly an executive function. It's implementing the policies of the board. And so you distinguish between that policy implementing function of the executive branch versus the policy making function of the legislative branch, the Board of Education.
So could we apply that here? So the work called for to be done by the committee, described by the ACI handbook, is that executive or legislative?
The ACI handbook itself?
No, the ACI handbook and 361.1 call for the creation of a committee to do curriculum review, correct?
The rules, I would disagree with that. Rule 361.1 itself does not call for the establishment of the committee, does not call for the creation of the committee.
Right,
it states that the board has responsibility for adoption of educational materials in a school district.
And 361.1 adopts the ACI handbook, yes?
The ACI handbook was adopted separately and apart from Rule 361.1. They're two separate.
Is that authorized? Is the ACI handbook recognized and authorized by the board?
The ACI handbook has been adopted by the board, yes.
Okay. And the handbook calls for the creation of a committee to do curriculum review.
Correct.
When that committee does curriculum review, is it exercising an executive or legislative function?
It is exercising an executive function.
So your position is that when the Board of Education delegates curriculum review to a committee, that is not open to the public?
Correct. That would be an action by administration, by the employees of a school district in which they are implementing policy. There's a lot more that goes into curriculum development in a school district besides just the adoption of textbooks and the adoption of reading books for a course. It's considering what are the teaching methods, what are the modes, how much time are we going to put forth for each of these particular classes, what technology resources are we going to utilize in educating our students, and all of those factors and all of those considerations are made by administration and by employees of the school district when they're implementing the policies that have been set forth by
all
the
right.
school board.
So let's change up the facts just a wee bit and say that the Board of Education did not delegate this authority to the committee, and it did it itself. If the Board of Education met to do a curriculum review, would that meeting be subject to the open meetings law?
If the board itself met to do curriculum review?
Yes.
Yes, that would be subject to the open meetings law.
Why?
Because in that case, you have a convening of the governmental body. The governmental body has met to have a meeting to engage in collective decision making.
But if it's just an executive function, not legislative, why is that subject to the open meetings law?
It would be subject to the open meetings law by virtue of the definition, I think, of the open meetings statute, that meetings of governmental bodies, which include subunits of government, are subject to the open meetings law. It's looking at the form versus the substance. The form of the committee is that it is a governmental body. It's the governing body of the entity. They are meeting to have a discussion on a matter over which they have authority. Over which they have authority and over which they exert authority.
Perfect. Thank you. So now they pick up that body, that quantum of authority, and they put it in someone else's hands. And you're saying that by the act of doing that, the person's hands in whom they put this, they're not subject to the open meetings law.
Well, I think Again, I think it's a distinction between executive and legislative functions. Legislative policymaking, creating the policy that the board shall provide curriculum, it's provided for in the Wisconsin statutes. There must be curriculum that a school board provides
right,
and maintains.
Right. And I get your distinction there. What I'm trying to get at is why it's subject to the open meetings law when the board does it, but it's not subject to the open meetings law when the committee does it.
I think I heard in your earlier response maybe a more apples-to-apples comparison would be if the school board were considering which textbooks.
No, I actually want to answer this question.
Well, that's fine, Justice Kelly, but I'm just trying to follow your question because, well, I'll hear the answer, but I thought I was trying to help because I don't understand your question.
Well, and I think that, again, I think the distinction comes back to what is the role that the legislature, or excuse me, what is the role that the governing body is carrying out? Are they adopting the curriculum and engaging in adopting the curriculum, or are they engaging in the development and creation of the curriculum? And the board doesn't engage in the creation of the curriculum. Their responsibilities pursuant to state statute are simply to provide curriculum and to maintain a sequential curriculum plan. That is the authority that the board has and what they consider.
Right. And if a committee...
So they took some of that authority and they delegated it to the committee, right?
I don't believe it is a delegation of that authority to the committee. The responsibility for curriculum is an inherent responsibility of virtually everyone who works in a school district, from your teachers, your curriculum support specialists, library specialists, to your administrators. It is a duty that's provided for by statute. DPI requires all districts to hire a curriculum director whose sole responsibility is to develop and implement curriculum in a district. The statutes also call for school boards to hire reading specialists. Reading specialist duties by virtue of statute is to develop a plan for K through 12 curriculum. And so in performing their inherent duties, their administrative functions of the school district, of which are their inherent authorities under the statute, they are not performing the legislative policymaking function.
So what you're saying is the committee can recommend but can't make the choice. It's only the board that can make the choice, and that's why the board's meetings would be subject to the open meetings law, but the committee, who has no authority to make the ultimate policy choice, but just to make recommendations, is not. Is that correct?
Correct. And only the committee, correct, and the committee only has that ability to make recommendations. They don't have the legislative ability to adopt curriculum.
Right. But advisory committees are subject to the open meetings law, right?
Advisory committees could be subject to the open meetings law if there is a formal directive, rule, or order from the governmental body creating that advisory committee, yes.
So the Board of Education adopting 361.1 and the ACI handbook calling for the creation of a committee to do X, that would qualify as a rule, wouldn't it?
Again, I don't believe that 361.1 is a rule that calls for the development of curriculum. Again, it's distinguishing between what those functions are, the policymaking function versus the administrative function of the governmental body.
Now, you like the Court of Appeals decision. Is there anything you would change about the Court of Appeals decision? Is that what you want us to hold, just like the Court of Appeals did?
I would agree with the Court of Appeals decision that this is a committee. If you look at the facts of this specific case, the CAMREC, this review committee that we're talking about, was not created pursuant to a rule or order of the board. It wasn't created pursuant to Rule 361.1. It wasn't created pursuant to the ACI handbook. It was created by Bunno and Steinhilber in their capacity as administrators in the school district.
That's under paragraph 21 of the opinion, as I understand it.
Yes, that's correct.
What their ultimate decision is. And is that the rule you want us to adopt? I'm trying to I think your brief raises a very good point at page 40, which is that you can't have a rule, the court cannot adopt an interpretation of the statutes that says every time you get three people together or two people together, that that is an open meeting law. It's an open meeting under the law, and that administrators can't discuss anything without it being an open meeting. And that's what your position is, if I understand your position. So my question, which I think is what various members of this court are trying to get at, is, okay, what rule do we adopt? When I say rule, what opinion do we write that separates out every administrative meeting from meetings that should be part of the open government, right? So what kind of opinion do you want us to write that separates the wheat from the chaff? In other words, what separates it? Open meeting, that is what has to be an open meeting under the 19.82 and following. And what does it? And what is the opinion?
As I've said, I think that that line that has to be drawn and that has been drawn by the legislature is to distinguish between the policymaking function, the legislative function of the governing body, and administrative functions, those
where
executive
functions.
Where is
that in the statute?
I'm sorry?
Where in the statute is that line? Oh, I'm sorry. My papers are covering the microphone. Where in the statute does that line that you have executive and legislative, where is that drawn?
Those specific words, you're right, are not specifically
not
stated in the statute.
So what words in the statute are you relying on to make that distinction?
Well, I think you're looking at what the very definition of a meeting is under 19.82 subsection 2, where you're talking about convening the members of a governmental body for the purpose of exercising the responsibilities, authority, power, or duties delegated to or vested in the body. So the only meetings that are going to be subject to the open meetings law under the statute are those in which the governing body here, the school board, has authority, power, or duties, and those, of course, could be delegated or redelegated or vested in another body aside from the school board. But it has to be that those responsibilities and the authority and power that is inherent in the board itself, okay. Not...
But don't we have that here? Because the board is responsible for ultimately selecting textbooks and reading lists, correct?
Correct.
And Board Rule 361.1 provides, quote, selection of educational materials is delegated. So we have delegation under the board rule. Yes?
Yes.
And it went to, in this case, the committee. Now, if I understand your argument, I think you might be disputing whether there was indeed a delegation from the board because it didn't come explicitly from the board to create CAMREC, correct?
Correct.
But it did come from administrators who were delegated the authority by the superintendent.
The administrators weren't delegated the authority by the superintendent because the superintendent doesn't have the authority to delegate the board's responsibilities or the board's powers. Nowhere in statute does it say that the district administrator has any legislative authority. They're very different than, say, a county executive or a mayor, which does have some level of legislative authority. Here, the district administrator doesn't have that authority. They don't have the authority to redelegate a board responsibility.
But ultimately, the work that was performed by the committee related to the selection of educational materials, in fact, they made recommendations regarding textbooks and reading lists to the board, which the board adopted without any variation, right?
Splitting hairs here, there was some variation. There was a period of public comment in which members of the public had the opportunity to comment on the recommended list of books that CAMREC took to the board. After receiving public comment and looking at that, one of the books from the original list was removed after public comment prior to the list being taken to the board. So just wanted to clarify that factual.
Thank you for the clarification, but with that exception, otherwise the committee's work was adopted by the board.
The committee's work was adopted by the board, but neither Bunno nor Steinhilber had any policymaking authority whatsoever. If they wanted to provide guidelines or recommendations to the board, they certainly could do that, but ultimately they had no authority to create policy. They had no directive from the board to create any type of policy for the school board.
Do you disagree with the Attorney General opinions that suggest that advisory committees fall under the open meetings law?
I don't disagree with that particular recommendation, so long as there is a directive that comes from the governmental body itself, explicitly creating that body to perform a policymaking, a legislative function of the board. And so if there is a committee that has explicitly been given that rule or order to engage in that type of decision making, then there are times where that advisory committee could be subject to open meetings law, but a group of individuals that comes together on their own accord and performs their administrative function, their day-to-day responsibilities, can never be subjected to open meetings law without that rule or order of the governing body.
If I understood your answer to Justice Kelly's question, and frankly, I wanted to ask the exact same question. I'm glad he did. If the board did what the committee did, it would be subject to open meetings.
I think if the board did, it would be subject to open meetings law by virtue of the board, again, collectively meeting to carry out their responsibilities and power under the definition of meeting in the open meetings law.
And then Chief Justice Rogensack followed up, and her question of you was just slightly different, I think, and that was not if the board did what the committee did, would it be subject to open records law, but your answer to her seemed to be it's because the board is the entity that can actually act, and that's what makes it different from the committee.
Correct.
Is that an accurate understanding? Okay. With the presumption of public access and transparency, how is the public properly assured that the board just isn't taking the tougher issues, farming them out to a committee, having the committee do that work, and then just come back and make recommendations that the board adopts, and the public's left out of the analysis? What's the assurance to the public, and how do you weigh that in light of the strong presumption that exists?
Well, there is the strong presumption of access, and I don't think that either the district, the review committee, or any of the amici briefs that were submitted disagree with the public policy pronouncement. But there is a second part to that sentence that the public is entitled to access as is compatible with the conduct of governmental business. And so I think you have to keep in mind that obviously the public is entitled to access, but it's only when the government is conducting business. And in terms of how can the public be assured that all these things aren't happening in secret and undercover, and then they're taking recommendations to the board and the board is just simply rubber stamping it, the open meetings law is only one part of the laws of Wisconsin that allow access to the public. We also have the public records law, which provides access to citizens of records. And the legislature has decided that under the open meetings law, the public is only entitled to access to meetings in which the governmental body is conducting business, in which it is legislating. Under the public records law, the legislature has determined that the public is entitled to records, that the public is entitled not only to the records of administration and the workings of management of a governmental body, but they're also entitled to the records of the school board as well. And so I think the public can have the assurance.
Would the committee records be the board's records?
Well, the committee records would be the records of a of the district, of the governmental body. And so the committee records would be subject to open records law. And in fact, they were subject, public records law, and they were subject to the public records law. The record shows that Mr. Krieger did make requests for the committee's records, the minutes, as they were called, that were kept by the committee. He was provided with access to those minutes. The public also had the opportunity to provide input to the review committee itself as to books they thought the committee should consider. They had that opportunity to do it, and in fact, Mr. Krieger did provide some book suggestions to the committee, which the committee took and reviewed. And so in this particular case, there wasn't the secrecy that Mr. Krieger seems to espouse here. There were plenty of opportunities for the public to participate, and again, there are two different avenues in which the public could participate under the law, by virtue of the open meetings law and also by virtue of the public records law.
I'd like, if you've finished answering the question, I have another question. Are you done answering the question?
Yes.
Because I'm surprised at your answer to the question. Now, I wrote down the question about there's a presumption of public access. And then how do you aren't you silencing public access when the board delegates it to a committee? And it seemed to me that your answer should have been that the board did not delegate to this committee.
I would agree with you because on what you said, that the board, in this particular instance, the board did not delegate to this committee.
And that your whole response previously was that the board did not delegate, that this committee was set up by administrators, and that they didn't have, that they were doing it in their administrative capacity, as in their executive capacity, not their legislative capacity, and it's the legislative capacity that is open meeting. That was my understanding. Now, had the board set up this committee and delegated to it its function of curriculum, then it seems to me it would have been an open meeting if I follow your argument down the line.
I think if the board would have said to the committee that the committee
set up a committee or said to the committee.
I'm sorry.
Would have set up the committee or said to the committee already set up. Is that what you mean?
If the board directed that a committee be created and made the proclamation that a committee shall be created to review this Communication Arts 1 materials book list and shall develop the list of books that will be used in the ninth grade Communication Arts 1 course, then I would agree with you. In that case, there's been the directive of the governmental body creating the committee to specifically engage in policymaking to create the curriculum.
And then it would have been an open meeting. I'm not saying it is. I'm just trying to get your position, and that was my understanding of your position.
Yes, that's correct. That would be my position.
So here's the part that I need to parse down, and that is you said had the board... Would you tell me again what you just said, if the board had said what to the committee?
Had the board created this committee and given the directive that a committee shall be created to develop the reading list and create the reading list for the ninth grade Communication Arts 1 course, the board gave that directive to the committee, then I think arguably that committee would be subject to the open meetings law because there's been that directive from the governing body to engage in a specific policymaking function.
Then I did not understand your legislative policy versus executive content argument, because I thought you were saying that by engaging in a decision as to which specific books would be included in the curricula, that would not qualify as a policymaking or legislative transaction, decision-making process, which would subject the committee to open meetings law. But you're saying that had the board specifically said that to the committee, that would have been good. That would have been good enough.
And I, Maybe we're splitting hairs here. Maybe it is a matter of semantics.
Well, I did begin by noting we're parsing it, but that's what it's coming down to, yes.
And again, I think we have to really focus on that distinction between policymaking. And there, I think that you had the directive from the board. We're engaging in policymaking. We're adopting this textbook list. We're adopting the curriculum. If they've delegated that specific task to the review committee, then it's going to be subject to open meetings law.
Even with the 30-day review period and the public comment.
I think you probably present a different question if you back up the process and have it's not just simply the adoption of the book list and the creation of the book list. If you back that up to sort of the initial stage where CAMRIC operated here, where you have a committee that is looking at the book list as a whole and is taking into account the various moving pieces of curriculum for Communication Arts 1, then I think that is the administrative function of the body. That's engaging in those administrative functions. That's not engaging in strictly the adoption of the curriculum itself.
So is your answer yes?
Yes, what?
Yes, to my question that even including the 30-day public comment period that had the board delegated specifically to the committee following the facts of this case. It's not complex. Following the facts of this case, but adding a specific directive from the board to the committee, then the committee is subject to open meeting law.
I think that might be difficult to say because, and I say that because you have to, I think, take into account that these are the functions that these individuals have been hired to perform. It's their daily functions that they engage in, part of their daily responsibilities. And that authority isn't authority that the board has. The board doesn't have the administrative function authority that those individuals do and the administrative responsibilities that those individuals engage in on a public basis.
So without the 30-day comment period and review period, yes, it is subject to open meetings, but with the 30-day public comment period, you're not so sure.
I don't think it's a matter of what the substance is that the individual, I take that back. It is what the substance is because it has to be the responsibilities, the power, and authority of the board that the committee is engaging in order for it to be subject to the open meetings law.
Okay.
Thank you.
May I have a couple moments to conclude?
Very briefly, your red light is on, and you did have 40 minutes, so we gave you extra time already.
Very briefly, I just want to reiterate that line has been drawn, that it's clear by the legislature, it's clearly understandable that when a body engages in policymaking, it's subject to the open meetings law. When it engages in administrative functions, it's not subject to the open meetings law. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I'd like to start by returning to the question that Justice Abrahamson assigned to me to come back and address. I believe that what the Department of Justice is getting at in that portion of its brief is that there are really two requirements for applicability of the open meetings law. One is that you have a rule and order that creates a body that's assigned a task. And the other thing is it has to be a body. It has to have defined membership. It has to meet, and it has to exercise collective decision-making. And what I think the DOJ was saying in that portion of its brief is that this parade of horribles, these ad hoc meetings where a couple of people get together around the lunch table and they talk about textbooks or something like that, are not likely to meet those requisites of a body, and so the open meetings law isn't going to apply.
If this committee had merely heard the concerns of Mr. Krieger and looked at his concerns and did nothing else, would you still believe it was subject to the open meetings law?
If all it did was consider the request for a new course, then it would not be subject to 361.1 in the handbook because it didn't set forth a process for responding to a new course.
Okay.
Of course, that's not all it did.
I understand that. My question was,
yes. But you're really had two focused. Issues, 361 and other issues.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
You're not relying only on 361.
We're not only relying on 361.1. We're also relying on, in the alternative, on the delegation of this board task to the ACI department. So even if you somehow can get around the language of Rule 361.1 in the handbook, it's still the case that 361.1, the board clearly delegates responsibility, delegates its function. The board says in 361.1, it's our responsibility to select educational materials, and we're going to delegate that to the ACI department. Now, we argue that they also approved the handbook that said that this has to be done by committee, and that essentially set up the materials review committee. It said, from that point on, if you're going to review curricular materials, you got to do it through a committee. But even if that hadn't happened, or if we can somehow conveniently ignore that, they delegated the responsibility for doing this to the department that Steinhilber ran, and when Steinhilber decided to set up a committee in order to perform that delegated function, it became subject to the open meetings law. I'm confused by this distinction between legislative and executive functions. This is nowhere in the law. The legislature could have passed a law that made that distinction, but it didn't. The legislature could have passed a distinction that said that there are certain functions of government that are just too mundane and unimportant to be subject to the open meetings law, but the legislature didn't do that. What the legislature focused on was not the power that the committee has, but the way in which it was formed. But even if we somehow could say that there are sort of executive or administrative functions that are somehow immune from the open meetings law, that's not what we have here. We don't have day-to-day functioning of government. We have the very rare, here it hadn't happened for 8 years, policy decision to select educational materials, to select textbooks, something that the board itself acknowledged that it was responsible for and that it had to approve and that it did approve. And so even if you think that you can import into the law this distinction between legislative and executive or administrative functions, this falls on the legislative and policymaking side of the line.
What's the narrowest grounds on which you can prevail?
I think the narrowest grounds on which we can prevail is that in this case, the school board adopted a rule which delegated a board function, that is the selection of educational materials, to the ACI department and approved a handbook which provided that when that happens, it has to be done by committee.
I have problems with your 361 argument, and they're focused on the very answer that you gave a couple of questions ago. When you were asked if it was just a committee that addressed a reading list, would it be violative of 361? And your response was no.
No.
I thought, bingo, that's the very problem that exists in the Court of Appeals opinion in paragraph 20, because they said the same thing. They said, well, look, 361 doesn't deal with developing alternative courses, and so it doesn't apply. The problem with that is it requires magic words. By that, I mean, the whole essence of this complaint wasn't necessarily alternative courses. The essence of this complaint was the books that you're using, and I'll be general, offend my moral compass, something akin to that anyway.
And so the Court of Appeals in paragraph 20 and you just recently say, well, unless they articulate it correctly, see, he asked for an alternative curriculum, even though what was bothering him was the reading list, but he didn't use the magic words. And so you're falling into that same trap.
No, I'm not falling into that same trap because that's a hypothetical, which is not this case. That is...
Well, you responded to it, and you responded to it with rather a certain approach.
I did, but we would have to undertake an entirely new analysis to decide whether or not the board had delegated the function of responding to requests for new courses to some entity within the school district. One might very well conclude that that falls within Steinhilber's purview, that it's been delegated to him, and then when he forms a committee, it's subject to the open meetings law. But we don't have to get at that in this case because they went beyond that. They went beyond that to decide that they were going to perform the very function that the board had delegated them. So when you say that is the narrowest grounds that we can win the case on, I think, yes, that's the narrowest grounds that we can win the case on. Of course, I don't think that's the only ground that we can win the case on. I am sure that comes as no surprise to you, because it seems to me that even if you decide that there's something about 361.1 that makes it inapplicable here, that Steinhilber nevertheless was exercising a board function when he decided to create a committee in order to review these materials.
Thank you.
I see my light is on. Thank you very much for your consideration this morning.
Well, all you answered in my question was that there are two requirements, a rule and a body defined. Then you went into executive versus legislative.
Justice Abrahamson, we are not going to be fair to the parties on the other side if you proceed onward, because I didn't let her proceed except for a very brief closing argument when her red light was on. His red light is on, and I ask you to refrain and rethink your question.
I will. How do you get around the Attorney General?
So you choose not to be fair to both parties and to ask him to answer your question briefly, please.
I don't think I have to get around it because I think it's talking about something else. I think what the Attorney General is saying is that not all groups of employees will exercise collective decision-making, but Kamrick did exercise collective decision-making.
And do you agree with the AG about that, that not all groups of employees that exercise collective decision-making they're not all open.
They've been created by a rule and order that assigns them a task, and they have a defined membership, and they exercise collective decision-making, then they're subject to the open meetings law. If they're just an ad hoc group that comes together and talks about things, no.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 2:00.